You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
For this week's installment of our series Strapped, A Look at Poverty in America, we discuss the social safety net, welfare, food stamps, pre-kindergarten, Medicaid, and other federal programs designed to help people living in poverty. Olivia Golden, Executive Director of the Center for Law and Social Policy, and Michael Katz, Walter H. Annenberg Professor of History and Research Associate in the Population Studies Center at the History Department at the University of Pennsylvania, also the author of The Undeserving Poor, America's Enduring Confrontation with Poverty, which was updated and revised in just last year and published by Oxford University Press. They join us now to discuss the origins and history of these programs, the debates over their funding and support, and whether they address the underlying causes of poverty. Welcome to our show.
Thank you for having me.
Michael, what programs actually count as part of our social safety net?
Well, there are many programs, Leonard. If we begin with a basic income support, public assistance, so TANF, what was used to be called AFDC, food stamps, are probably the most well-known, and there are state and local programs as well. Certainly the earned income tax credit. There are programs, important medical programs, Medicare and Medicaid are crucial parts of the social safety net as well. I like also to think of education programs, the War on Poverty Initiated, Operation Head Start, the Elementary and Secondary Education Act of 1965, which has pumped unprecedented federal dollars into local schools. And we don't want to neglect, I think, in this legal services, which provide low-income people with, unprecedented and crucial access to the criminal justice and civil legal systems.
So most of these things have come along in the last 50 or so years since the War on Poverty, although I assume a few date back to the New Deal.
If you go back to the New Deal, of course, we have Social Security, which is in some ways the granddaddy foundation of them all, along with unemployment insurance.
Olivia, let's use a single mother of two children who earns less than $19,000 a year as an example. What federal programs would she qualify for?
Well, a couple of headlines and then an answer. The first is, I'm glad you gave me an example of a working mother, because one of the things people often miss is how much of the safety net is about working people. And we can come back to some numbers, but a lot of poor and near poor parents raising kids are working. In terms of what she's eligible for, the headline about our United States safety net is that only a few of the programs, particularly for children and families, are consistent nationwide. So she's going to be eligible for food stamps. Now it's called SNAP, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, everywhere, because that's a national program.
Although it's being cut back.
Yes, it remains a crucial program, particularly for kids and families, and crucial nutritionally. For health insurance coverage, one of the interesting things is that a huge accomplishment of the last couple decades is health insurance coverage for children, but the new change, which has big potential for parents, like that single mother herself, is the Affordable Care Act, which expands coverage under Medicaid to adults. And her ability to get that coverage is going to depend what state she lives in, unfortunately. So that's a challenge. She's likely also to have access to the earned income tax credit. And I'm really glad that Michael added unemployment insurance and Social Security as part of the safety net, because I think they are, were she to lose her job, we would hope she was eligible for unemployment insurance. Unfortunately, it doesn't do a great job of covering low-wage work, even when people work very hard.
Would she be on what people commonly call welfare?
No. I guess one thing I would highlight is that the TANF program, Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, is very small at this point and is unlikely to serve someone. You described someone who was working and had earnings near the poverty line. TANF is extraordinarily variable by state. In Texas, I think it reaches maybe under 10%, 5 or 6% of poor households with kids. In a state like California, it might reach somewhat more than half, nationally maybe a third, but it's very unlikely. Now, I should say that it's possible she might get help in paying for child care that had some TANF dollars in it. There's, again, a huge backlog and unmet need for low-income parents getting help paying for child care. It's crucial to working, but it's hugely more need than people are able to have. So I think the headline is we have very many people in poverty are working and trying to raise children at the same time. And while our safety net has gotten better at addressing that in some ways, there are still very big challenges really very much posed by the nature of low-wage work.
Michael, your book, The Undeserving Poor, was first published in 1989. The title kind of suggests what the prevailing attitude was toward addressing poverty at that time. Has the situation changed much over the past 25 years?
Well, it has, and it hasn't. In the sense, there are new programs that Olivia mentioned, which are extraordinarily important. We've had cutbacks in others. You know, we had the major shift away from AFDC to TANF. But the idea of the undeserving poor, the idea that some people are in poverty as a result of their own inadequacies, that has been a constant, really, for hundreds of years in our discussions of poverty, and it undercuts attempts to expand the safety net in the way that Olivia rightly suggested it should be, and it helps explain its inadequacies. It's also the case that in the discussions of the undeserving poor, while the general idea persists, the content of the categories shift over time, so that the same people, you know, are not always the most prominent. In 1989 and right up until 1996, I would argue that when people talked about the undeserving poor, the image that came into their mind was an unmarried woman not working with children and a woman of color. I think that has faded with the changes in the welfare legislation, and now that category is composed more of black men, of undocumented immigrants, and we're seeing a resurgence of biological explanations for poverty as well. There's been really a major shift in the strategies for dealing with poverty. It's what I call the rise of market-based technologies of poverty work. That is, strategies that are based on market models, attempt to use markets to jumpstart anti-poverty efforts in inner cities, or microfinance, conditional cash transfers, which you had so much in New York City, and asset building, which has become such a prominent movement. That whole strand, these kinds of market-based technologies, are really something that have come into prominence only in the last several years.
My guests are Olivia Golden, Executive Director of the Center for Law and Social Policy, and Michael Katz of the University of Pennsylvania, and author of The Undeserving Poor, America's Enduring Confrontation with Poverty. Michael mentioned the changing models, and Paul Ryan has recently been criticized for saying that men in the inner city have no culture of work, that they're, I'm quoting, not even thinking about working or learning the value and culture of work. And some people have heard inner city as code for black men. He defended himself, saying he didn't mean the remark to be racist. But wasn't he voicing an opinion that many others share, the belief that poverty among minorities in the inner city is the main problem?
I think that the gap between what's true and what people believe is very great, and you've just put your finger on one piece. On the one hand, and I want to highlight that if you look at CLAT's website, you can find a lot of work on these issues, on young men of color, as well as on broader fact sheets about poverty. So on the one hand, it's clearly true that Black and Latino families are disproportionately poor. On the other hand, it's also true that poverty is extraordinarily widespread, and it's extraordinarily true for working as well as non-working people. It's one of Michael gave what was a, I think perhaps a slightly optimistic view that people are no longer hold a stereotype that it's women who are not working that are the problem. When I talk about this issue, I constantly run into the assumption that whether it's for men or for women, the poor are not working at all. And so I sort of talk to people about how 2/3 of poor children live with at least one worker in their household, and about 1/3 of poor children live with a worker who's managing to work full-time and full year despite the recession. And that's even more true when you look at the near poor. So I think while it is absolutely true that for a whole set of reasons in terms of access to education and to good jobs, Black and Latino families bear the burden disproportionately of low-wage work and of intermittent work, the extent of work among low-income people, I think, is not widely understood. And so as a result, that's one of the reasons that people would hear that comment and think that the problem is culture. It's not working 60 hours a week at, or working hours that change week by week at a home care job and, you know, having your hours cut down 1 week and raised the next. I think people don't necessarily have a picture of the way in which low-wage work and its intermittent nature, as well as the wages and the lack of benefits, affect the circumstances of a very broad swath of poor people and families.
Michael, don't statistics indicate that there's only a small difference between the poverty levels in cities and in rural communities? And in 2013, 38.8% of welfare recipients were white, 39.8% were Black. Not all that much of a difference there.
Yeah, I want to reinforce what Olivia has said about how wrong it is for us to equate poverty with color, with race, and with inner cities. In fact, one of the most alarming and prominent trends that people have just begun to point to is a tremendous rise in suburban poverty. The rates there are very high, and they have been growing. So, in fact, poverty is a national problem. We find high rates of poverty in every, you know, kind of a geographic setting, and there is this vast gulf between what people associate with poverty when they think of the term and so on, and what the actual demographic reality is.
Well, what accounts for that rise in poverty in the suburbs?
Well, you know, I think there are various things at work. One of them is that the Great Recession hit the suburbs very, very hard. Lots of people who lived in the suburbs had their house, you know, lost their jobs, lost their houses, and, you know, had very high medical bills, so that people who never would have expected to find themselves in poverty suddenly were there. It's also the case with suburbs that are close to inner cities that the kinds of problems that have come with the deindustrialization of cities and their economic decline, those problems have moved out to the near-in suburbs and also are raising the poverty rates there.
My guests are Michael Katz, who is a professor of history and a research associate in the Population Studies Center at the History Department of the University of Pennsylvania, author of The Undeserving Poor, America's Enduring Confrontation with Poverty, just recently revised and updated for publication late 2013, and also Olivia Golden, Executive Director of the Center for Law and Social Policy. We're talking about the safety net on today's segment of Strapped, a look at poverty in America. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. We're back with our series, the second in our series, Strapped, a look at poverty in America, with Michael Katz, Walter H. Annenberg Professor of History and Research Associate in the Population Studies Center at the History Department of the University of Pennsylvania, author of The Undeserving Poor, America's Enduring Confrontation with Poverty, published by Oxford University Press, and Olivia Golden, Executive Director of the Center for Law and Social Policy. Michael, have there been many comprehensive studies evaluating how effective the safety net programs really are? Can they actually lift people out of poverty?
Yes, Leonard, there have been, and the 50th anniversary of the War on Poverty has, in fact, inspired more of them. And I would just give a call-out to a very authoritative recent book by edited by Martha Bailey and Sheldon Danziger, who's president of Russell Sage Foundation now and one of the leading researchers on poverty. It's called Legacies of the War on Poverty, and it's a book that consists of essays by very reputable academic economists looking at the economic impact of all of the major programs that went under the rubric of the War on Poverty and Great Society. And they came out with a very optimistic set of conclusions. While they weren't starry-eyed and they, you know, pointed to flaws and faults in programs, but that overall their verdict is that most of these programs worked, and they worked very well, and they lifted people out of poverty, and that poverty would be much worse and much higher today without them.
Well, Olivia, in 1996, during the Clinton administration, there was an overhaul of welfare, the Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Reconciliation Act. Was that a welfare to work program, wasn't it?
Well, and as you know, I was there as the assistant secretary who implemented the law. And what I would highlight about that reform, it was to focus on work, and about what's happened since, is that at that point in the mid-1990s, changing the welfare program to focus on work came with a whole set of other supports for working families. So we greatly increased the resources available to help pay for childcare, for example, which is crucial if you're going to work. The Medicaid health insurance program and the SNAP program changed so that families who left welfare for low-wage jobs would have more of an opportunity to continue to get some help, not to be able to, you know, not to suddenly lose all of your health coverage, and the earned income tax credit, the same thing. And it was also a very strong economy. So what's happened since that's made that program far less relevant to most of today's poor is, first of all, that the federal government hasn't expanded in any way its dollars for that program in what's now more than 15 years, and so that means that there are very few resources available. The TANF program didn't help out during the recession in the way that some of the other programs did. In addition, we now have a very slow economy, and so private sector jobs aren't as much of a solution. And we never took the additional steps that were needed to finish the work of addressing the circumstances of people in who are struggling in low-wage jobs. They basically need the ability to move up, and they need help getting there. We need, you know, better conditions in that work, minimum wage and better conditions. So I do think that part of where we are is that low-income people, and particularly mothers, have hugely increased their work efforts since the beginning of the War on Poverty. One of the biggest changes in those 50 years is not just the government's doing more, but poor parents are doing hugely more, yet we haven't addressed what it takes to be able to work and raise a family in the context of what low-wage work is like.
Now, the reform now is called, as you said, TANF. Did that also change how states fund welfare?
It did. I mean, overall, as I said earlier, one of the big challenges about the United States safety net is that the safety net for the elderly is national. Social Security, Medicare are national programs and have had if you look back at the Danziger book or any other source, have had enormous impacts on poverty among the elderly. But the safety net for children and families is a mixed federal-state safety net. And so for all the programs, states have some role. As you highlight, the change for the welfare program was to a block grant, which means that the federal government gives states a capped amount of money. And since it didn't increase that amount of money in almost 20 years, what that's meant is that it doesn't go anywhere near as far for states. And there's all kinds of other technical issues like what the purposes are and how the federal government sets rules to judge what states do. But I just want to highlight one other federal-state area that I think is really important, which is what we do for children. Michael mentioned Head Start, which you could think of as a part of our education agenda or as a part of our safety net. But given that children are the poorest Americans and are very likely almost a quarter of children live in poverty, and more than 40% if you add in near poor families. What we do to help those children have an equal start in life and to help their parents work while not constantly worrying about the quality of the settings they're in, that's a crucial part of the safety net as well. And so that's another area where the federal government is key, so are state and local investments.
Well, Michael, in 2012, the federal government spent about 12% of the federal budget, $411 billion, on programs that make up the safety net: earned income tax credit, child tax credit, food stamps, school lunch, housing assistance, home heating assistance, supplemental security income for the elderly and the disabled. Does federal and state spending on these programs tend to fluctuate depending on the economy, on the labor market, or which party is in office?
Well, yes, I think it does tend to fluctuate. Well, some spending is built in, like for Social Security, for instance. And
which is called an entitlement.
Yes.
Is that the right word to use?
For Social Security, certainly it is an entitlement. Medicare certainly is an entitlement. You get them not through any means test or any judgments about your character or your work effort. You get them because, you know, you're a certain age. So there are built-in escalators that increase the amount of those programs, and those would have to be shifted in order, you know, to change the amount that's spent on them. But for the others, they do vary a lot, and they vary, you know, on different axes. Partly they respond to need when the economy tanks and goes into depression and the need rises, but partly also they're very sensitive to politics and to political mood and to political swings. And just as we're seeing right now with the SNAP program, how harsh the cuts in that program are, not because the program is ineffective, not because we can't afford it, you know, but simply because some of our legislators just feel that poor people shouldn't get so much food assistance.
And a listener wonders, why is the Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act not available in all states? Is that also political?
I'll let Olivia come in on that one.
Okay. So that's a crucial question. So the technical answer to why it's not available is that the Supreme Court, in its decision about the Affordable Care Act, said that the federal government couldn't mandate the states to make that expansion to Medicaid. And that's left it to the states to decide. About half the states have chosen. I think all three that your listeners are mostly in, New York, Connecticut, New Jersey, but about half the states haven't. And many of those are states in the South and Southwest, like Texas and Florida, with the largest shares of poor people who would benefit from it. And I think that I guess I have a number of perspectives on why. So first of all, I think it's crucial that over the next couple of years they do accept that coverage, because it matters enormously to people's ability to succeed in all of their lives, in work, as parents, in education, to be able to go to the doctor when you're sick, to, you know, not leave a chronic illness untreated. So what are the reasons why people haven't, why states haven't taken it? Clearly, it's become a big picture political symbol of big government, I think in ways that are inaccurate, because it's not a big government program, it's an insurance program, but it's become that. Then it can get up, caught up in very particular state politics. One of the things...
Excuse me, just for a moment. Yes. Is it ironic that the states that are most resistant are the ones that have the highest poverty levels?
It is ironic. It's also typical. I mean, one of the features of the United States sort of terrain on the safety net is that the highest poverty levels are in states in the South and the Southwest that also typically make the least investment and make policy choices that are less broad. Now, some of that in many programs is because if you have a lot of poor people, you won't necessarily have the revenue to make investments. But that's not true in this case of this Medicaid choice because the federal government is providing all of the cost in the first few years and a very large share going forward after that. So that's sometimes a problem, but in this case, it's not the heart of the problem.
Now, Michael, I mentioned entitlement before because there was a lot of talk about entitlement programs during the last presidential campaign and criticism of the, quote, takers who depend on the government for handouts that taxpayers pay for. So entitlement, which seems to be a perfectly benign word, suddenly became a pejorative.
That's right. It's one of the interesting things about the language of the social safety net in the last several years is the negative connotation that entitlement has taken on, when in fact it's something we should be really proud of. We should be proud that, you know, that we have made a commitment as a nation that no old people should be poor, and that we should make sure that that happens. You know, we should. Yeah, you know, it raises one of the fundamental questions that's always been part of discussions of poverty, you know, and for as far back as you can go, and that is, you know, it's essentially a moral question. You know, what are the limits of our obligations to each other? What do we know we owe each other as members of communities, as citizens, as a nation? And people answer that. Those questions in very different ways.
Well, didn't a British politician during the Irish potato famine say he didn't want to help because that would lead to a culture of dependency? That's a phrase we've been hearing a lot recently. Do people who receive welfare or food stamps rely on them for a long time, like decades, or are they usually more short-term?
I mean, the interesting thing when you look at the data is that most people who receive these programs receive them only for short periods of time during emergencies. The number of people on the rolls who are long-term recipients really is a fairly small fraction, you know, and of course one that varies with the economy. And that notion, I mean, that's another of the kind of major enduring questions, this question of moral hazard, as the economists would call it, that if you give people help, you will just make them dependent and make them less willing to help themselves and work on their own. It's, I think, really been a very pernicious idea.
And then, Olivia, there is the image of the welfare queen, more recently the surfer, who we're very proud of the fact that he lived off of government support. And they become the symbols of the problem.
And in order to make them symbols, you often have to willfully ignore the broader research evidence. I mean, you asked before, has there been research about the implications of these programs? And I want to note that some of the areas of the research that I think are particularly important for people to think about are the implications for those who are working now, because remember I said that a lot of the participants are people in low-wage work who couldn't afford to buy health insurance on their own or couldn't stretch the paycheck to cover putting food on the table, and the implications for children. And that research typically shows that for those low-income working families, getting access to nutrition help, to health insurance, to child care subsidies, helps meet basic needs. People go to the doctor, they buy food. It has, though the evidence, there aren't as many studies as we'd like, it likely has good effects for children's development. Growing up in poverty is terrible for children, and you don't solve it totally by making sure they have enough to eat, but that helps. And third, and this I think is very relevant to your question of the stereotypes, having a package of these work support programs actually looks as though it helps you stabilize your work and move up and be on the benefit for a shorter amount of time. So, for example, people who left welfare and didn't get some support from food stamps or from child care subsidies in an early job, or low-wage working people who are trying to make ends meet without help paying for child care, run a big risk that something's going to go on in their life. You know, the roof's going to leak, the car's going to break down, it's going to take money, your life will be chaotic, you'll miss work, you'll lose your job. Kind of one of the things that happens to people struggling on the edge is that their lives spiral. And so if you're getting some help to stabilize your life, that gives you much more likelihood of working steadily and eventually moving off. And I think people really, by focusing on a story that's rare and not focusing on what the research says is typical, you could get the wrong ideas about what would be the best way for policy to move.
New York Times reporter Ron Nixon pointed out that when he was in a discussion of the farm bill, that there's significantly more fraud when it comes to crop insurance for farmers than there is for food stamp recipients.
Sure.
But we have very little time left, and I want to go back to Head Start for just a moment.
Right.
3 years ago, Time magazine columnist Joe Klein called for its elimination, saying it doesn't work. On the other hand, we have Bill de Blasio, New York's mayor, talking about expanding pre-K. Why is there such a debate over it still?
Well, I would highlight a couple things. The first is that the broad evidence that early childhood programs of high quality pay off late in life is very strong. Second, the evidence about Head Start itself and early Head Start is very strong about immediate effects. And there's also evidence, including in that book highlighted by Sheldon Danziger, about long-term effects for young adults. What's prompted a lot of the debate is the complicated and hard-to-read evidence about in early elementary school. So if you get Head Start, it helps you right away. It probably helps you do better later in life. But can you see it in measuring performance in elementary school? And that's a hard question to answer. It's clearly about how good the school is, as well as about the Head Start program. It makes no sense to me to interpret that complicated evidence as saying you shouldn't do it. To me, it argues that this is a crucial foundation, and we should be thinking about what young children need as they grow up and continue.
Well, it's something that we probably have to look into in more detail in a future show. And we haven't even touched on housing, but we'll be covering that in a future segment of this Strap series as well. My great thanks to both of you, Olivia Golden and Michael Katz, for being on our show today.
Thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.